You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Our show today is about the profession of journalism and the threats and dangers that journalists worldwide are facing. We'll be talking about that in just a moment. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation strengthens education in northern New Mexico so that learners of all ages can reach their full potential, offering grants that fund public education and community projects, building resilient children, families, and communities through early childhood programs, providing K-12 wraparound services for students and teachers with Inquiry Science as the flagship initiative, investing in students' dreams through scholarships, and creating a solid foundation for learning and systemic change through partnership and advocacy. For program information or to give, visit lanlfoundation.org. Are we free without a free press? That was the big question posed last month at the conference Journalism Under Fire, which was held by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. The conference featured heavy-hitter journalists from places like The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Economist, and regional journalists from groups like National Native News and Searchlight New Mexico, and international journalists from literally all over the world. Some of the most interesting moments were conversations with writers and broadcasters from countries where freedom of the press is marginal. They told harrowing tales of doing their work under conditions of violence and repression, and of getting news stories out there against all odds. Which brings me to today's guest. Courtney Ratch is from the Committee to Protect Journalists, which is an international organization based in New York City whose mission is to promote freedom of the press worldwide. Courtney is a veteran journalist. She's author of the book Cyber Activism and Citizen Journalism in Egypt, and she's the director of advocacy at the Committee to Protect Journalists. I had the chance to talk to her at the Journalism Under Fire conference. Welcome.
Thank you.
So lay out for us the reality of the dangers that journalists face around the world for doing their jobs.
First off, journalists are regularly killed and murdered for their reporting. This includes journalists who are killed because of the nature of their assignment, so they might be covering armed conflict, but it also includes journalists who are murdered. Journalists are also being imprisoned at record levels. We've been keeping records since 1992, and we've seen historic highs for the past couple of years, with more than 260 journalists imprisoned last year. We're also seeing that journalists are being caught up in administrative type of harassment. So, for example, in the Philippines, one of the most important journalists there has been caught up in harassment related to taxes or charges such as hooliganism. And, you know, it's getting harder for journalists because they're really being squeezed between the state and government actors as well as non-state actors, whether we're talking about drug cartels or terrorist groups. And they rely on technology platforms over which they have very little control and are at the mercy of the algorithms and policies set by those platforms that determine the visibility of their work.
When journalists are murdered, and this happens all over the world, well, first of all, where are the greatest rates of murder and imprisonment in the world?
So Syria is the most deadly country in the world for journalists, but the U.S. is actually right now tied with Mexico in terms of the number of journalists who have been murdered. In both, there are at least 4 journalists that we counted who have been murdered this year. And just to be clear, you know, when we're talking about journalists murdered, we're looking at whether they were killed specifically in retaliation or because of their work. In terms of imprisonment, 3 countries account for more than 50% of the journalists imprisoned around the world. That's Turkey, which is the leading jailer of journalists, at least 2 years running now. China and Egypt. And Egypt used to have no journalists in jail, and now it's regularly in the top. And so between those 3 countries, they account for more than 50% of all journalists jailed around the world.
And why are they being jailed? Is it specific stories? Is it the kind of stories they're doing? What's going on?
We know, based on our reporting and research, that the vast majority of journalists who are jailed around the world are jailed on anti-state charges. So that includes charges such as terrorism or supporting a terrorist organization or being a member of a terrorist organization. And that is a trend that has actually been occurring for several years. And we've seen how in the post 9/11 era, the war on terror era, that journalists are increasingly being equated with terrorists. It's very convenient for countries to be able to claim that independent or investigative journalism or critical journalism is terrorism. And unfortunately, you know, the worldwide and the US-led efforts to combat terrorism through, for example, cybercrime laws and counterterrorism laws, in many countries, those laws end up being used against journalists who are reporting about terrorists. For example, in Cameroon, there was a journalist named Ahmed Abba who was reporting about Boko Haram, and then he was charged with terrorism. In Turkey, journalists who are covering the PKK, which is a designated terrorist organization there, are designated as terrorists and accused of terrorism. Same in Egypt with journalists who are frankly reporting on anything. I think all of the journalists in Egypt right now are charged with some form of terrorist-related charges.
How does it benefit the state to be going after journalists and calling them terrorists?
In many states, there's very little interest in having independent or critical reporting on the activities of the government or the potential links with organized crime or whatever the issues might be. And so I think that the idea of charging journalists with terrorism, first of all, there certainly is a real issue around terrorism globally, obviously. But the problem is they're translating that and using that as a cudgel to restrict independent reporting, the investigative reporting, for example, into corruption or into politics. They have equated that with terrorism. And in some cases, for example, in Egypt, it's actually illegal to report on terrorist statistics that don't match the official statistics provided by the Ministry of Interior. So, you know, we're seeing a wide range of ways that these terrorism provisions or restrictions are being used because they don't want independent reporting. They don't want reporting that is looking at what are the government policies, for example, in Sinai in Egypt, or, you know, what is Turkey doing in Syria or on the southern border, just to pick a couple of examples. But we really are seeing this around the world.
There was an example that was on your website in Canada of a reporter who was reporting on terrorism, and the Canadian Supreme Court unanimously forced him to give over his sources. And I guess one can see their side of it, but from the journalism side, it's a real problem. Talk about that case.
So the case of Ben Makuch in Canada, where he was reporting on terrorist-related activities and has now been required to hand over his sources, is a real black day for press freedom, for journalists, and for the protection of their sources in Canada. The fact is that one of the fundamental principles of journalism is the ability to protect your sources. And in many cases, you know, journalists are the only reason that we know what is happening in many of these countries with many of these terrorist groups. So if we undermine their ability to create relationships with sources that enable them to promise anonymity and to tell those sources that they will protect their identity by a ruling like this, it's deeply problematic. You know, the government shouldn't be outsourcing its intelligence responsibilities to journalists.
Right. When a journalist is killed, for example, how do you determine whether that murder was for reasons having to do with their profession?
It is hard to do that in many cases. So we have three categories that we classify the killing of journalists. One is crossfire. So it's pretty straightforward. If you're reporting on Afghanistan or Syria or anywhere where there are guns or explosions and you're killed because you're there reporting on it, that's pretty straightforward. But even then, you know, you have to determine, was that person there as a reporter or was that person there on, I don't know, vacation or doing something else? With respect to dangerous assignment, that has to do with, you know, whether the assignment was either inherently dangerous or became dangerous. And so the case of Kim Wall, who was killed in Sweden covering this guy's submarine, is a case where in our database it's classified as a dangerous assignment because it became dangerous. She was not targeted directly because of her work. She was killed, it looks like, because she was a woman. And certainly in Sweden, it was classified as a murder. But we're looking at murder as a category of looking at retaliation because of a journalist's reporting. And so we've actually seen a rise in the number of journalists murdered over the past year, more than 50% rise over the year prior. And unfortunately, what's happening there is that journalists are either murdered because of a story that they've written or a beat that they work on. But it's very difficult to figure out in many cases. One example is Victoria Milanova, who was killed in Bulgaria. And right now, she is an unconfirmed case for us because we have not been able to determine whether or not it's related to her journalism. She was murdered in Bulgaria reporting on her news show with some other reporters who were reporting on corruption. But we don't know. You know, there's not always a note. Sometimes, of course, journalists are murdered clearly because of their reporting to send a signal to other reporters to be careful and shut up.
What are some of the particular dangers faced by women journalists?
Women journalists face all of the same dangers that male journalists face, but in addition, they're often facing sexualized violence and really pernicious sexualized online harassment. At times, we have seen, for example, with the case of Victoria, she was raped in addition to being murdered. We are also hearing from women journalists that almost across the board, they face online harassment. And frankly, that is becoming endemic to being a journalist. It's just part of the profession now. But when women experience online harassment and online threats, there's often a sexualized dimension. So whereas a male reporter might get real vitriolic attacks because of his reporting on X, if a female reporter is reporting on X, those threats might also come with threats of sexual assault, of rape related to her children, etc.
One group that I didn't know was so vulnerable was political cartoonists. And here we are at this conference where I heard a group of political cartoonists talk about their work. Is it because cartoons are so easy to ingest? I mean, not everybody reads, but everybody watches the cartoons. What's going on?
Yeah, political cartoonists have long been at the forefront of the journalistic community in terms of threats and harassment. Already, we think of journalists as kind of the canary in the coal mine. Oftentimes, we see that journalists and restriction on press freedom precede broader crackdowns on human rights and civil liberties. And cartoonists are at the very forefront. You know, they're the first canary into that coal mine. And I think that is for a variety of factors, as you alluded to, the fact that cartoons encapsulate so much in such a simple way. It doesn't often require that you be literate. It often plays on social or cultural tropes that have real resonance in a given context. And I think it's that reach that they can have and the ability to transcend literacy that can have a big impact.
And again, female political cartoonists are even more harassed than males. I mean, there was a female political cartoonist who did a cartoon that made fun of Ted Cruz, and she got so many like death threats and people who said that they wanted to rape her until she died.
Unfortunately, those types of threats are not uncommon. The threats that female cartoonists, that female journalists face oftentimes are just really vitriolic and, again, like include that sexualized violence. But it can also be the circulation of photos, of doctored photos or undoctored photos. And it really depends on the context in which we're speaking, because in some cultures, it's unacceptable for a female journalist to be shown in the company of a male or drinking or, you know, naked or whatever it is. And so we've seen how that has been used against journalists. There's a case in India right now, Rana Ayub, who's facing defamation charges. She had to flee the country because she had such vitriolic attacks online. Someone circulated a doctored photo with her face on it that ended up really endangering her life with a lot of threats on it. So we had to help her get out of the country temporarily.
I can understand, even though it's a horrifying thing, how government could be angry at journalists and imprisoned journalists, and how drug cartels will be angry at journalists who are investigating them. But the general public, I mean, people out there in social media land, what is going on with that? What is the source of all that vitriol?
Well, I think when you're seeing the vitriol come from government officials, that sends a signal to the public that, you know, this person is an enemy of the state, or this person is against our party, or whatever it is. And so, of course, that creates a permissive environment. So we've seen that in the United States, for example. After President Trump tweets against a specific reporter, we've documented how that can lead to a lot more online harassment from the public. But it also, you know, I think in many countries, we're seeing these state-led trolling attacks against journalists, which, again, sends a signal to the public that this is an appropriate way to deal with critical or covers that you don't like. But it's also part of this broader information environment that really is in flux. So, you know, over the past couple of decades, we've seen the rise of the internet as our primary platform for getting news. We've seen the intermediation of social media platforms as the platforms by which we get our news, and the implications of that. And many of these platforms, the algorithms that determine what news we see, do appear to favor kind of extremist views and extremist reporting. There is this fake news trope that has become so common since President Trump really elevated that into a global meme. And so there are all of these forces that are kind of combining to undermine people's ability to understand what is the truth, to understand reporting and the role that journalism plays in democracy.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We're going to take a quick break. Please stay with us. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation invests in the dreams and futures of Northern New Mexico students through scholarships. Support is available for 4-year and 2-year degrees, as well as trade certifications. January 22, 2019 is the deadline to apply for 4-year scholarships available to high school seniors and current undergraduates who are residents of the 7 counties of Northern New Mexico and meet additional criteria. Citizenship is not required. For more information and application details, visit lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. And now back to our program. The murder of Saudi Arabian journalist Jamal Khashoggi has shocked the world, both for its bloody horror and because of our president's apparent lack of concern about it. Why was he killed?
It seems that Jamal Khashoggi was killed because of who he was in Saudi Arabia and the platform that he had in the Washington Post for his critical commentary. There are, you know, many journalists who are being imprisoned in Saudi Arabia. It's a very, very violent country. You know, they still beat prisoners, they torture. And so it's been interesting to see this outcry around this particularly brutal and unprecedented murder. But the fact is, you know, the kingdom has long been a very problematic place. But I think that with Jamal, he was part of the establishment before he became a critic. So he was part of the establishment. He basically went into self-imposed exile in the United States, and he decided to become a columnist for the Washington Post. And the Washington Post is one of the most influential papers in America, and certainly among policymakers. And typically, the U.S. has had a very close relationship with Saudi Arabia, despite the fact of the 9/11 hijackers being from Saudi Arabia, despite the, you know, massive human rights abuses that have been documented there and the restrictions on women's rights, etc. And Jamal was writing critically about Saudi Arabia during a time when it was doing a massive multi-million dollar push to improve its image. And with Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, taking over power and adopting this new initiative strategy for Saudi Arabia and trying to garner international support, this insider turned critic was very problematic, it appears. And so they decided to murder him.
When a journalist is imprisoned for their work in another country, what is the role of your organization?
So the first thing that my organization does when a journalist is in prison is we document it. Because one of the most important things is to know that a journalist has been imprisoned. It's not like there's a list that countries put out of like, here, the journalists be in prison today. And that really is the foundation of everything we do is our reporting. That then allows us to try to understand why were they imprisoned? Have they been charged with something? Who is bringing the charges, right? Is it an individual HISPA case in Egypt, for example, or is it, you know, the state who has made an accusation of terrorism or whatever the case may be? And then that will allow us to figure out, well, what can we do in this case? Should we send a letter? Do we do a public campaign? What other groups are working on this case? How can we work together with them? And then every December, we do an annual prison census. And that is to look at a global snapshot of every journalist in jail on December 1st. Now, we spend months in advance looking at that because, again, it's not easy to find out about some of these journalists. And sometimes, like Jones Abiri in Nigeria was missing for months and they thought that maybe he was dead. And then we were able to find out that he was in prison. So that research is really important. The prison census allows us to get a global snapshot, but it takes a lot of time to find out if these journalists are alive, what are the charges, etc. And we'll do missions to countries where we will take a delegation to go there and meet with the government. So for example, in Egypt, I went with a colleague to Egypt to meet with the Minister of Transitional Justice and the Minister of the Interior, et cetera, to advocate for the release of the journalists who were being imprisoned there, especially this one photojournalist, Mahmoud Abu Zayed, who goes by the name Shao Khan, who was a photojournalist wrapped up in an arrest of like 900 people covering the Rabaa massacre and trying to get those officials to see our point of view, which is that this person was there doing journalism, documenting. And Shao Kahn was not arrested for his journalism. I mean, he was arrested for his journalism, but ostensibly because of terrorism-related charges, because it was a Muslim Brotherhood-related protest. So it really is a range of activities here at the Journalism Under Fire conference. We have brought our postcard campaign here where we have identified a handful of journalists around the world that we've really been focusing on trying to get out of prison. And we are asking people to fill out postcards in solidarity with them and send them a message and we'll get it to them or their families so that they can know that people outside care about them and know. And then also we use international mechanisms like the UN Human Rights Council. We will file complaints with the Special Rapporteur on freedom of expression or arbitrary detention. The Global Magnitsky Act may be a mechanism that we can use. So it really depends. I mean, every case is different. And, you know, in places like China, there's very little that can be done with the government. You know, they're not exactly open for discussion. But that's when we also have to look at different ways of how can we influence. So for example, Cameroon was going to host the African Cup, the football game. And we wrote to the head of the African Cup to make sure that he was aware of the increasingly restrictive environment on the press there, the fact that they had journalists jailed, and the dangers that journalists could face in trying to report on those games. So it's really looking for where are the levers, where are the pressure points, do we have any ways that we can influence?
What was the result of that letter?
It took a while, but I just read that the African Cup decided not to go to Cameroon.
Interesting.
And it's not that that is necessarily, you know, we're not saying don't hold this event there, but I'm actually headed to Paris, to UNESCO, where there is a big forum called the Sporting Chance Forum, where the International Olympic Committee, FIFA, Formula One, all these big international sporting groups that hold major international sporting events in countries that including repressive countries to try to integrate human rights considerations into the hosting of those games. So for example, the European Olympic Committee is going to hold the second European Olympic Games in Belarus. Well, the first ones were held in Azerbaijan. So what happens is journalists who are reporting on these games, or for example, the Olympics in Russia or in China, maybe they're reporting about environmental degradation related to the staging of the games. Maybe they're writing about workers who have been killed building the stadiums in Qatar for the World Cup. and then they face repercussions. Or maybe journalists are prevented from entering the country. So we're trying to leverage those sporting bodies to increase protections for journalists. So it's really a wide variety of different types of activities that we do, pressure points, public and private advocacy.
How responsive are repressive governments to international publicity, concerns, pressure of the kind that you're putting on them?
Definitely, it varies by country.
Yeah. I mean, you said China's not responsive.
I mean, China's not responsive. Like, look at, even with the Nobel Prize winners, and that's the Nobel Prize Committee and the entire world speaking out, and they still didn't budge.
Yeah.
So that's a really challenging case. So yeah, it varies. And you have to look at things like, are there a lot of international correspondents going back and forth there? Does that country get a lot of foreign aid? Does that country care about its international image? Or are they a pariah state, for example, like North Korea and Eritrea really aren't susceptible to public pressure, it seems. But other countries, so in Tanzania, a few weeks ago, my colleagues went there to do what we call a reporting trip, to just talk to journalists, understand the press freedom environment there, what were the challenges they're facing. And my colleagues were arrested. They were detained overnight. Their computer, someone hacked their account and sent out a tweet. And, that was a country where we didn't think that was the sort of environment they would face. And we immediately, my colleague, as she was being detained, sent a tweet saying, "Hey, I'm being arrested." And that prompted us immediately to start campaigning for her release. And so she'd already put it out on social media. And we were able to contact government officials, and she's South African. My other colleague is Kenyan, as well as the U.S., because we're based in the U.S., reaching out to Tanzanian officials. They were thankfully released the next day. But we heard from the Tanzanian officials when we went to see them at the UN mission in New York, that they had seen that public campaign on Twitter. And they actually mentioned, the social media campaign, and you see these things on social media and you don't know that they're true, and all this kind of ridiculous excuses. But it exemplified the fact that they were, I think, unprepared for the amount of attention that doing something like that would get.
It's important to talk not only about the dangers to journalists and the cost to them and their families and their communities when they are killed or imprisoned or exiled. I mean, some people, they get to safety, but they're not in their country where they can report. The loss is also that loss of voice. I mean, it's the loss of their stories, their information that they're giving to the public.
Right, absolutely. So one of the things that CPJ, the Community Direct Journalist, does is we provide emergency assistance to journalists, and we have helped many journalists go into exile either temporarily or permanently. So during one period, we did an analysis over a five-year period that of the about 500 journalists that we were able to help, only 25% were able to stay in journalism. And that's a huge, huge loss. So when a journalist is killed or imprisoned or attacked or intimidated or exiled, that silences them, but it also impinges on the rights of the public to know and to get information, because journalists are not just there doing journalism for their own, interests. They're doing this as a public service. So much of what we know, whether it's about massive U.S. surveillance globally, or whether it's about environmental issues in the Amazon, or whatever the issue is, it's because journalists have looked into that, have investigated that, and reported that to the world. So much of what we know depends on journalists. And that means that the ability of the public to hold officials accountable, to hold business or economic leaders accountable, to be informed and knowledgeable about what's happening really depends on journalists. So an attack on a journalist has these broad ripple effects and broader repercussions on the public.
Now, most journalists, except for maybe, certain TV personalities or whatever, but most journalists really don't want to be part of the story. They want to cover stories and precisely not draw attention to themselves. Does that make it harder to get coverage about what's actually happening to them?
I think that sometimes it has been hard to get journalists to cover the issues of journalists that journalists are facing for that precise reason, that they don't want to be the story. But I think increasingly journalists are realizing that they can't just let others fight the battle for press freedom, and that the issue of a journalist, being attacked, being killed, it is newsworthy because, again, it impacts on that broader public. And it is inherently newsworthy when a journalist is killed because of their reporting, because that has implications for whatever they were reporting on, whatever that issue was.
We seem to be in a kind of dark period right now where there seem to be authoritarian regimes coming up all over the world, and the United States is a country where journalism is the only profession that is specifically protected by the U.S. Constitution in the First Amendment. And yet it does seem to be a very dark period for democracy and for journalism. What about the other side? I mean, have you seen countries where freedom of the press and the safety of journalists has improved? And what are the conditions that would allow it to improve?
I don't have a good answer for that. Honestly, I think that if you had asked me this question a couple of years ago, there were clearer examples of where we've seen improvements. In the Middle East, there was this brief period of opening, which was very exciting. I mean, one example that comes to mind is Ecuador. There has been a transition in power there that has led to a realization by the president that the situation that the press was under Correa was really detrimental. And so I think that is one of the bright spots right now, but there are very few.
What else would you like listeners to know?
I think it's important for the public and listeners to know that journalists need the support of the public, and for individual listeners to think about who brought you this story. Who is that byline? What did they do to bring you this story, and the very real personal costs that that can take? And it's not just the hardcore human rights or political stories that can get journalists into trouble. And it's not just those stories on the front lines of a conflict, but journalists across the board, when they're reporting, even if it's on business or on sports, do so oftentimes at a cost. We just reported over the summer during the World Cup about all these female reporters who were harassed while covering the sporting events, and in many cases by fans. The sexual harassment that we saw even on video with some of these women when they were reporting there. Myself, when I was a reporter in Dubai, I was the managing editor of an English website there, and I published a story about safety problems on the national airline, and I didn't even know people read our business site. I thought that it would be my stories about human rights situation in the labor camps there that would be problematic, but in fact, it was this story about public safety that got me fired and kicked out of the country. And the economic impact that that can have on a reporter, obviously, the reporters who can no longer cover their beats or cover the countries or issues that they were covering because they've been forced out of that profession or out of that beat for whatever reason, like that has a real toll. And I think it's important for the public to not just think about journalism as talking heads or punditry, but to really think about how much of what do you know because you heard it from a journalist, because you read an article that a journalist brought you?
And I think the other thing that we've gotten far away from, and it's very important to kind of reestablish and for teachers to teach, is the idea of a loyal opposition. I mean, we have lost this in Congress and in the sort of two-party system where when one party comes in, the other party says, okay, we don't like it, but we'll work with them. We don't have that. And the same thing in a lot of ways with journalism. I mean, you read a story that has a perspective you don't like, you read another story, you use it to understand the world better. And we've lost that, and we really need to, as a society and as a world, somehow reclaim that.
I think it's very challenging because, there is some truth to this idea that we're in a post-truth moment where all of these things that we used to take as fact or authoritative, whether we're talking about science or journalism, are really under attack. And In part, this is because of attacks by those in power, but it's also in part because of the communication platforms that we use to get our news and exchange our views, many of which are based upon a logic that favors engagement and therefore favors a more extreme point of view because that might be more likely to create or encourage engagement. And so, you know, it's a very tough moment we're in because of the decline in authoritative voices and fields and the platforms by which we get this information.
Courtney Ratch is Advocacy Director with the Committee to Protect Journalists. They're on the web at cpj.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
To find out more about the Journalism Under Fire conference and to hear podcasts of the conference, you can go to Santa Fe Council on International Relations. Their website is sfcir.org. On the next Radio Cafe, we'll be talking about the upcoming legislative session and what to expect with the Democratic Party in control of both houses of the state legislature and the governor's office. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.